It is a damp October afternoon in 1986 in a quiet residential part of Retfarnham, South Dublin. Two teenagers are walking home from school, taking the same narrow shortcut they have taken dozens of times before, along a laneway that runs between rows of neat suburban houses. The ground beneath their feet is dark and slick from days of relentless rain. Fallen leaves are pancaked flat against the concrete by passing footsteps, when something out of place catches their attention. Lying in plain view, just a few feet ahead of them, is a soft canvas school bag, dark in colour, its straps twisted beneath it, one of its small metal buckles hanging loose, creased and partly collapsed, marked with dirt and wear and resting among damp fallen leaves. The ground around it is wet from days of rain, but the bag itself does not appear soaked. At first, the girls assume it has simply been dropped by another pupil, someone who will come back looking for what they have lost. But as they draw closer, they begin to feel that something is not right. There's a name scrawled in marker on the bag. One of them kneels down and carefully unzips the main compartment. Inside are schoolbooks and copybooks, neatly stacked, their covers unspoiled by rain or mud. And on the front page of several of them is the same handwritten name. Philip Kearns. Philip is 13 years old. He lives nearby. And Philip has been missing for 6 days. Since his disappearance, his photograph has appeared in every newspaper and on every TV and radio bulletin. Posters have been taped to shop windows and lampposts, and search parties have spent days combing parks, fields, housing estates and laneways like this one, looking for any sign of him. Volunteers have walked this exact route in recent days and are certain this bag was not here before. The bag has been left in a location that has already been searched. It has been placed in a position where it cannot be missed. And despite days of rain, the bag is bone dry. Is this the breakthrough they've been waiting for? Or is it a message from someone who does not want Philip to be found? When someone disappears in Ireland, the first question is always the same. What happened? Not who might be responsible, not what rumours are circulating, not what theory feels plausible. Just that single brutal question that begins and ends with the same two words. What happened? What happened in those missing minutes? What happened on that stretch of road? What happened in that gap in time where certainty ends and speculation begins? When serious foul play is suspected, or a body is discovered, the Gardaí bring in the technical bureau to examine it, quietly, methodically, with the evidence the scene cannot help but leave behind. For 25 years, I was one of those forensic detectives at crime scenes. You know the ones. White coveralls. The men and women beyond the crime scene tape. My name is John Sweetman. I learned to read what people do not notice. The pressure a fingerprint leaves on a glass, the angle of a blow, the trace of a weapon moved and cleaned, the small mistake that tells the truth. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting investigations. This is Lines of Inquiry, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the story behind the headlines. In this episode, the disappearance of Philip Kearns, and the question that has tormented his family for 40 years. What happened to the boy who never came home? In 1986, Ireland was a far cry from the country we now see. A sense of innocence and naivety filled the air. Front doors were left unlocked, and young children played unaccompanied with their friends for hours on the streets. No phones, freedom. The onset of darkness, or a mother's wail over the back wall that dinner was ready, was enough usually to bring an 80s child home. Singer Christa Berg's Lady in Red was the song everyone was slowly becoming sick of. It featured so often on the airwaves. And Hurricane Charlie had just battered the country. The 20p coin was introduced into circulation and Jack Charlton took over as the new Ireland football manager. But there was one event that year, arguably more than any other, which stopped people in their tracks and touched every home in Ireland. In late October, just as the schools were gearing up for their Halloween midterm break, a 13-year-old Dublin schoolboy by the name of Philip Kearns would become a household name. Philip's case holds a unique place in the Irish consciousness. Nearly everyone who lived through the late 1980s remembers the name Philip Kearns. His face, a smiling boy in his school uniform, became a symbol of every parent's worst nightmare. For a generation, Philip's unsolved disappearance changed the way people watched their children, the way doors were locked and streets were lit, and it cast a long shadow of fear and intrigue. It also brought people together. Hundreds joined the search parties, communities bandied together, and tips poured in from across the country. It is a case that in many ways has haunted the nation since. Philip Kearns was born on the 1st of September 1973 and was one of six children to his mother Alice and father Philip Sr. The family lived on the tree-lined road of Ballyroan in Rathfarnham, which, as cliché as it sounds, was the definition of a leafy, safe suburban area in South Dublin. The stone-washed grey house with its large front garden and driveway, which fitted two cars, stood out from the rest with its orange-painted garage door. The 80s were brighter, very literally. Everything from clothes to house paint was colourful. Local children walking to and from the nearby primary and secondary schools accounted for most of the passers-by. A largely middle-class residential area, it was considered a safe place to raise a family, and it was part of the reason why Alice and Philip Sr. decided to move to the area in the first place. Alice, who was originally from Castlecomer in County Kilkenny, instantly loved the area when the couple were house hunting and was only delighted to move there. A religious woman, she loved being within walking distance of Ballyroan Parish Church, a church where she and Philip, as he got older, would go to for prayer meetings. The home of the Kearns family was a very stable, loving home, where Philip lived with his parents, Granny May, and his four sisters, Mary, Sandra, Helen, Suzanne, and younger brother Owen. Philip Kearns was a slight, soft-featured 13-year-old with dark hair that fell neatly across his forehead. He had a gentle, open smile that seemed to belong to a child younger than his years. In photographs released by the Gardaí, he stands carefully posed in what looks like his confirmation clothes, well-dressed, tie straight, shoulders slightly forward. There is a quietness in his expression, a thoughtfulness behind the eyes. He looks like a mannerly chap, courteous, the kind of boy teachers describe as conscientious and classmates remember as kind. Nothing about Philip was rebellious or restless. Instead, he was settled, steady, comfortable, and above all happy in the ordinary routines of school, family and home. Philip was a very happy boy, who liked routine and according to his father, Philip Sr., was so regular you could set your watch by him. He liked to be home from school on time and loved to be at home with his family, according to Alice. Even as he got older and approached his teenage years, he was always well behaved and never gave his parents or teachers any trouble. He was extremely close to his younger brother Owen, who was just 18 months his junior, and who Philip shared a bedroom with. They would often spend hours playing football with each other after school. Long shots, World Cup, heads and volleys, Philip loved football. They were more like best friends than siblings. Like most teenagers, Philip was starting to appreciate music, and among his favourite bands were Irish rockers U2, Def Leppard, and English reggae band UB40. He loved music so much that he'd even drawn a U2 logo on the front of his battered school bag, alongside a barely visible UB40, which had been scribbled on the fabric with red pen. his name, which had been written in black marker in a style that replicated the logo of Def Leppard, was on the back of it. Most lads his age at the time had the same style canvas bag, which were generally bought in Armley Surplus or camping shops around Capel Street. As Philip's interest in music began to broaden, Ireland's pirate radio scene was entering its most influential period. Throughout the 1980s, unlicensed stations flourished across the country, attracting loyal teenage audiences by broadcasting the emerging bands and alternative sounds that RTE, as the state broadcaster, was slower to embrace. For many young listeners, pirate radio was not just background noise, it was discovery, identity, and access to a world that felt newer, louder, and more exciting than the one presented on official airwaves. While stations like Radio Dublin played tunes from New Order, Wham, Madness, and David Bowie, over on RTE Radio, an unedited and uninterrupted reading of James Joyce's Ulysses was airing over 30 hours in 1982. Philip liked listening to his favourite music, and no doubt would have been tuned to Radio Dublin to hear the type of music that wasn't heard on the more stuffy, older-focused RTE. As well as music, the first-year student also loved football and the GAA, and would often be seen wearing his oversized Dublin jersey. Philip also hadn't reached the stage in life where you tell yourself your parents are uncool and spend all your time with your friends discovering music and girls. He enjoyed the company of his parents and would often go fishing with his father. A quiet teenager, Philip had only made his confirmation months earlier, starting at the nearby all-boys secondary school Coláiste Aíonna in September 1986. He wouldn't have been a brilliant pupil, according to his mother Alice, but he listened intently and tried his best. The move from primary school to secondary is a daunting leap for any child. One year you're among the oldest, the most confident, the ones who know every corridor and classroom. The next, you're back at the very beginning, navigating unfamiliar hallways, older students, new routines and the subtle hierarchies of teenage life. For Philip, that transition appeared to be going well. He was embracing his growing independence, making his way to and from school on his own, settling into new subjects and new friendships, adjusting to the shift from being at the top of the ladder to starting again at the bottom of it. On the afternoon of October the 23rd, Philip left Coláiste Aíonna at 12:45 p.m. and made the 10-minute walk from his new school to have lunch at home. He often walked to and from school with his friend Dean Dowling, who lived close by. It was an ordinary morning in the Kearns household, albeit with one small disruption. Philip's sister Helen had stayed home from school with a severe toothache. Helen's toothache had been worsening for several days. That morning, they tried to reach the local dentist, only to discover he was away. With the pain becoming unbearable, Alice had to make the trek into town to the dental hospital in Dublin city centre instead. Philip's sister Suzanne and his grandmother May were in the house that afternoon too, as Alice was trying to get Helen organised for the dentist. There were coats to find, bags to pack, pain to manage. Voices moved from room to room, doors opened and closed. In the middle of it all, Philip sat calmly at the kitchen table, enjoying the sandwich that had been made for him and quietly sorting the books he would need for his afternoon classes. Religion, geography, maths. He kept one eye on the clock. He knew what time he had to leave. At around 1:20 p.m, he lifted his school bag, slung it across his back, and prepared to head out for the short stroll back to Coláiste Aíonna. He had offered to stay at home and mind his grandmother while his mother brought Helen into town, but Alice told him not to worry, that Suzanne, who was 15, would stay instead. There was no need for him to miss school. Philip stepped into the hallway and called out, "Cheerio, Gran, I'm off," before pulling the front door shut behind him. Nobody watched him walk up the driveway. On a normal day, Alice would have followed him to the white cast-iron gates and stood there for a moment, watching as he made his way up the road. But this was not a normal rhythm. Helen needed to get to the dentist. There were things to organise. There was no time to pause. In the kitchen, Alice assumed he had gone. "He's a big boy now," she would later say. I was in the kitchen and took it for granted he had gone back to school. As far as everyone in the house was concerned, Philip was on his way back to class. They would see him later that afternoon. It was, after all, just a Thursday. For all of us, every day is normal until it's not. Philip never made it back to his first year classroom that afternoon. When he failed to appear, his new teachers assumed he was unwell or that something had come up at home. In a busy secondary school, a single absence does not immediately raise an alarm. At 5 p.m, when Philip Sr. returned from work at Nestle and noticed that his son was not yet home, he didn't panic. Philip was usually through the door by 4:15 p.m, but he had only recently started secondary school. New friends, new routines. It was easy to imagine he had lost track of time somewhere along the way. It was not unusual. Not yet. But when Alice returned from the dental hospital with Helen at around 6:30 p.m, and the house was still without him, the mood shifted. By then, the light was beginning to fade from the October sky. The cold had settled in, and the explanation that had seemed so reasonable an hour earlier no longer held. Alice began making calls. She contacted Philip's friends, including Dean Dowling, whom he would often meet on the way back to school. No one had seen him. No one had walked with him that afternoon. Panic began to manifest outwardly. You could tell Alice was worried. She hurried to the home of Philip's best friend, Enda Cloak, hoping he might be there. He was not. No one had seen Philip since lunchtime. By now, something felt deeply wrong. As the evening darkened, so did the fear. The family could not understand where he was or why he had not returned. Philip was not a boy who wandered. He was not reckless. He was not the type to disappear without telling someone. Enda's father, Paddy Cloak, a serving Garda, took their concern very seriously. He contacted Rathfarnham Garda Station immediately to report Philip missing. Local Gardaí, joined by officers from nearby stations, began searching the area. Friends and neighbours gathered. Doors were knocked on. Gardens and green spaces were checked. Fields and laneways were combed into fading light. But there was no sign of Philip. Hour by hour, hope and dread traded places in what must have been an unbearable, adrenaline-filled panic inside the Kearns household. All they could do was wait for daylight, clinging to the belief that morning would bring news. He fully intended to go back to school that day and was not the type to talk to strangers or wander off, Alice said. He loved to be at home with his family and always came home from school on time. As night gave way to morning, there was still nothing. No sightings, no clues, no trace of Philip Kearns. By the end of that first night, he was no longer simply a schoolboy who had failed to return home. Philip was at the centre of one of the largest missing person searches Dublin had ever seen. Just 24 hours after Philip was reported missing, a high-ranking officer who had initially called the Kearns house decided to put out a full nationwide alert. The Garda inspector called in members from nearby Garda stations to begin a full-scale search for Philip. His decision was influenced by the bad weather, which had engulfed the country. That and the schoolboy's age. Philip's family, who had moved to the area from St. Columba's Road in Drumcondra in the 1970s, were very well liked, and locals offered their assistance in any way they could. Like all missing teen cases, investigating detectives questioned whether Philip could have run away, but that was quickly ruled out, as the £40 he had saved in his building society account remained untouched. At the outset, Nothing about the scenario screamed runaway teen to investigating Gardaí and Philip's family. Inspector Pat King, who was overseeing the search for Philip, said at the time, "We're still treating it as a missing person case, but his disappearance is totally inconsistent with the boy's behaviour. He had a good relationship with his family." The nearest thing the Gardaí got to a lead during the initial few days of the investigation was a report by a woman who said she had picked up a teen fitting Philip's description in Kilshannan, County Tipperary. She claimed the boy said he was from County Wexford and had slept in a guest house, but the woman formed the impression that he was sleeping rough. For a few tense hours, the family allowed themselves to believe. Then the confirmation came. The boy who had been seen was safe. He was at home. He was not Philip Kearns. In the first few days, Philip Sr. also checked with the wider family to see if he was with them, including his wife Alice's relatives in Kilkenny. "He hasn't been with any relatives or friends. My feelings are that he wasn't a child to run away. The only thing I can think of is that someone or something must have, by way of coercion or trickery, taken him," he said. 3 days after Philip was reported missing, on the October bank holiday Sunday, Philip Sr. reiterated just how happy the schoolboy was before going missing, and how the family were becoming increasingly concerned for his safety. Philip Sr. told the press, "It's now over 48 hours, and if anyone can help trace him, please do." Meanwhile, a team of 25 highly skilled detectives combed the area around Rathfarnham looking for Philip, who was last seen wearing his Coláiste Aoine uniform. It consisted of a dark grey V-neck school jumper, grey trousers and shirt, a grey jacket with black squares and black leather shoes. Officers spent every waking hour combing local woodlands, wastelands, derelict buildings, abandoned sites and open spaces. They also carried out extensive house-to-house inquiries, and county council workers were called in to lift manhole covers so the sewers could be scoured. As well as inquiries, Gardaí also did searches of houses, sheds and outbuildings in the area. Local rivers were also dredged. No stone was left unturned in the search for Philip Kearns. Detective Inspector Jerry O'Carroll, who worked on the case, recalled a few years ago how he had never seen a search of this magnitude before or since. "It was one of the biggest manhunts of my career. We had people from every department, from forensics to the murder squad involved. We sent out teams of 20 or more men, and if they found resistance at a house, or if a person was reluctant to let them into the house, the attic, the shed, we got a warrant." As the days passed by and there was still no sign of Philip, all his devastated family could do was sit and wait, praying and hoping they would receive a call to say he had been found safe and well. A black and white picture of the youngster was placed in every local shop window, pleading with Philip, if he had run away, not to worry. He was not in any trouble, and they just wanted him to return home. His heartbroken mother, Alice, begged the teen to get in touch. She said, "We hope you will come home soon. Don't be worried about anything. We just want you home." A photograph of Philip, which was taken for his confirmation, his angelic beaming face front and centre, was also on the front page of every newspaper. In the space of 24 hours, the Kearns family's private world was blown open. The quiet rhythm of school runs, homework, fishing trips and family dinners was replaced by flashing blue lights, television cameras and reporters calling at the gate. Philip was no longer just a 13-year-old schoolboy from Rathfarnham. His photograph was printed on front pages, broadcast in national bulletins and pinned to notice boards across the country. Overnight, his face became one every household in Ireland recognised. As Philip's disappearance made national headlines, the investigation was quickly overwhelmed not just by genuine concern, but by cruelty. A series of prank phone calls began to flood into the Garda incident room. Each one diverted time and resources. Each one raised hope, however briefly, before extinguishing it. and each one brought fresh anguish to a family already living through every parent's worst nightmare. One call, received by a company in Tala, was particularly chilling. It had been recorded on an answering machine. A male voice said, "I am Philip Kearns. I ran away from home. I can't go home. Tell the family I'm sorry. Thank you." For a moment, it must have felt like a breakthrough. But when Gardaí analysed the recording, they ruled it out. The voice did not belong to a 13-year-old. Investigators believed the caller was older, perhaps 15 or 16. In another incident, someone telephoned the Kearns family home directly. The caller remained silent. In the background, a young boy could be heard crying. At the time, Gardaí acknowledged the grim reality of high-profile cases. The disappearance is high-profile, with all the media coverage, and there are people out there who make these types of calls in this situation, one officer said. Retired Detective Sergeant Tom Doyle, who later headed the investigation from 1998 to 2016, recalled that the bogey calls did not stop. The family were repeatedly tormented by individuals claiming to know what had happened to Philip. "There was a lot of mistreatment of the family," he said. "There were people ringing and saying they knew where Philip was. They got a call from a member of the public at one stage to say he was at Swords Garda Station, and they had him and didn't want to discuss it too much over the phone and asked them to head over. His poor father left work and they drove over, and sure, the guards in Swords had no idea what they were talking about, as it had not been them who'd called." No one was ever prosecuted for those calls. And while officers continued to search fields, knock on doors and follow up on sightings, the investigation was being pulled in a dozen directions at once. Leads emerged only to collapse. Promising information dissolved into nothing. Despite the scale of the search and the intensity of public attention, the case was already beginning to stall. Local parents also now feared for their own children's safety, and many kids were no longer allowed to continue walking to and from school unaccompanied. Panic had crept into every household that there was a child snatcher at large. Detectives were baffled as to how there was not one confirmed sighting of Philip that afternoon after he left his family home, even though the road he would have walked down was very busy at times. There were a few reports from members of the public who claimed they spotted a child fitting Philip's description that day, but none that could be categorically confirmed. Officers thought they had made a breakthrough when forestry workers in County Wicklow reported seeing a number of young boys in a wooden shack near a local forest. One of the boys fitted Philip's description. Gardaí descended on the Ballinamesa area, just 7 kilometres from Wicklow town, following the tip-off. Unfortunately, the hut turned out to be empty, and officers were back to square one. One sighting in particular was treated with real urgency. A man driving along Ballyroan Road on the afternoon Philip disappeared reported seeing a red car, possibly a Renault or a Mazda, parked awkwardly and obstructing traffic. The vehicle caught his attention because of how badly it was positioned. Irritated, he wrote down the registration number on a slip of paper before continuing on his way to the airport. He later told Gardaí that he had also seen a schoolboy dressed in a Coláiste Aina uniform approaching the passenger side of that car. The driver, he said, appeared to be a man in his 50s with grey, unkempt hair. It was a potentially significant account, but the crucial detail was lost. While the man was away, his wife cleaned out the car and threw away the scrap of paper with the registration number on it. The description of the vehicle and the man behind the wheel was noted carefully. Detectives held onto it in case it surfaced again. On Wednesday, October 29th, 6 days since Philip had gone missing, teachers and pupils from his class were brought back during the midterm break. 18 detectives spent 3 hours interviewing them. taking formal statements from each boy. Every classmate said the same thing. They had last seen Philip when he left school at lunchtime to go home. None had seen him return. Gardaí also examined claims that Philip may have been bullied, that he had been targeted by older boys, possibly because of his religious faith. Detectives pursued the theory, they tested it, and ultimately they ruled it out. Another line of inquiry closed. Officers had interviewed classmates, teachers, neighbours and family friends. Fields, housing estates and laneways had been searched. Every credible sighting had been checked. Every rumour logged. And still there was nothing. No confirmed movement. No reliable witness. No explanation. Then, at 7:45 p.m. on that same Wednesday, October 29th, less than 1 kilometre from the Kearns family home, something finally surfaced. 2 18-year-old friends, Catherine Hassett and Orla O'Carroll, were walking through a narrow laneway that cut between Anne Devlin Road and Anne Devlin Drive. It was a route locals used every day. A dark, enclosed passage, poorly lit, rarely busy at night. They had walked it countless times before. That evening, something caught their eye. Lying beside a lamppost, partially in shadow, was a faded grey school bag. At first, it didn't make sense. It looked too clean, too neatly placed, too deliberate. One of the girls had walked through the same laneway earlier that day. There had been nothing there then. No bag. No sign of anything unusual. Now suddenly it was there. They stopped, looked again, walked closer. It was Philip Kearns' school bag. Inside, written in black marker, his name had been written across the fabric and on the books. The girls didn't hesitate. They understood immediately that this was something Gardaí needed to see. Officers who examined it were struck by how strange the discovery was. A Garda spokesperson would later say that the bag had appeared quite mysteriously and that investigators believed there was a sinister motive behind its placement. There were details that made it even more troubling. Throughout the day, rain had fallen on and off across the area. Roads were wet, pavements were slick, clothes were damp. But the school bag was bone dry, as though it had never been outside. Officers also knew something else. In the days after Philip vanished, the same laneway had been searched repeatedly. Gardaí had walked it, examined it, checked every corner. Nothing had been found. The bag had not been overlooked. It had not been missed. It had been brought there later, placed deliberately, and left to be found. Inside the bag, Philip's school books and belongings were still there. They appeared untouched. But investigators were not taking anything for granted. Later, it was discovered that 3 of his books were missing. Inspector Pat King confirmed that the contents were sent for forensic examination. Specialists began analysing the pages, checking whether anything had been removed, altered, or hidden. Every detail now mattered. For the first time since Philip disappeared, Gardaí had physical evidence. Something tangible that could be tested, that might lead them to whoever had taken him. But the discovery raised as many questions as it answered. Who had kept the bag? Where had it been all that time? And why choose that moment and that place to return it? The investigation, which had been drifting, had suddenly taken a darker, more disturbing turn. One that suggested Philip's disappearance was no longer just a mystery, but something far more deliberate. Philip's mother Alice said the teenager would have only used the laneway where the school bag was found if he was making his way to the local church or library. Superintendent Frank Hanlon appealed to whoever left the bag in the laneway to come forward. "We are very anxious to clear up the whole question of the bag, and we want to talk to whoever left it there. They will not be in trouble, so we urged them to contact us. The following day, detectives turned their attention to the two girls' schools, which were right beside Coláiste Aonach, Sancta Maria College and Our Lady of Mercy Convent. As pupils of the schools all shared the same two shortcuts, Gardaí were hoping some key eyewitnesses would come forward, perhaps even the last person to see Philip. But yet again, the detectives' efforts yielded no results. Philip's aunt, who was helping the family at the difficult time, said they were trying to remain positive that Philip would be found. Inevitably, at this stage, we fear the worst, but we refuse to abandon hope. His two sisters, Suzanne and Helen, returned to school, but his younger brother Owen was too upset to face it. Bridie Fitzgerald lived close to the laneway where the bag was found. She told of the impact it had on her at the time. "It was found in the lane beside my back garden wall. I'll never forget it. I was worried that whoever left it there had been in my garden. The Gardaí searched my house and attic and everything, but nothing was ever found after that." On November 4th, Gardaí decided to carry out a filmed reconstruction of Philip's route back to school in a bid to help jog people's memories. A volunteer Philip Kearns lookalike named Ulton Whelan set off on his memory-jogging walk along the Ballyroan Crescent. He was chosen to play the part of Philip by the schoolboy's best friend, 12-year-old Enda Cloak. Of similar height and build to the teenager, he was dressed in the same uniform that Philip was last seen wearing. At the time, all the Kearns family could do was watch on tearfully as their loved one's lookalike walked out of the front door of the family home, uttered his final words, "Cheerio, Gran," and retraced Philip's journey. On the day of the televised reconstruction, Alice Kearns stood before cameras and spoke directly to whoever had taken her son. She suggested that the person responsible might now be afraid of the consequences, afraid of what would happen if they came forward. But she pleaded with them to do the right thing. "They must be in the situation where they feel they can't release him," she said quietly. "They may feel nervous to let him go, but I hold nothing against them. Revenge is not going to help." It was not anger that defined her appeal. It was hope. On Monday, November 10th, close to 300 local volunteers helped out in yet more searches for the youngster, this time combing woodlands and fields in the foothills of the Dublin Mountains. Among those helping out in the search were experienced hillwalkers and friends of Philip's from the Dublin Sea Angling Club. Although a number of random items of clothing were found throughout the day, detectives ruled them out as belonging to the boy. Meanwhile, posters appealing for information on the missing teen were circulated to every post office around the country. The local association of combined residents also printed off over 2,000 posters featuring Philip, who had at this stage been missing for 19 days. Over the following weeks, the investigation was flooded with alleged sightings. Philip was reported in towns and cities across Ireland, then across Britain, then across Europe. Each lead was followed, each location checked, and each possibility explored, and each time the result was the same. False alarm. Mistaken identity. Dead end. Again and again. For his family, there was no longer any doubt. Philip had not run away. Someone had taken him. Philip's father said he could not accept that his son would have gone with a stranger. Philip, he said, was careful, alert, not easily fooled. He would have known if someone was trying to coax him into a car. Certainly he would have never got into a car with a stranger, and if anybody had tried to force him, he would have put up a fight. As weeks turned into months, the search for Philip never stopped. Gardaí continued to follow up reports. Volunteers kept walking fields and lanes. The family kept answering the phone, hoping each time that it might finally be him. But slowly, painfully, the possibility of finding Philip safe and well began to fade. His father spoke openly about the toll the uncertainty was taking. "After 8 weeks of not knowing what has happened," he said, "the uncertainty makes life very, very difficult. I'm still hoping, but I'm very worried at this point. I have to keep hoping. Otherwise, I just couldn't carry on. By February of 1987, 4 months after Philip disappeared, the community gathered to show their support. On the 21st of February, friends, neighbours and parishioners filled the Church of the Holy Spirit for a 12-hour vigil. Philip's parents sat at the front, surrounded by hundreds of people who had watched him grow up. Parish priest Father Christopher Kenny paid tribute to the family's strength. "It's an inspiration to all of us," he told the congregation. "We have learned a great deal from Philip's family." But time kept moving. Months became years. The years did not bring answers. They brought anniversaries. They brought birthdays that were marked quietly at home instead of celebrated. They brought Christmases with an empty place at the table for dinner. They brought fresh appeals on television, on radio, and in the national press. Each one carried the same message: if you know something, say something. Searches continued. Specialist Gardaí units examined remote land. Fields were surveyed. Sites were sealed off and excavated when credible information emerged. Hope would rise, then it would fall again. 2 decades passed, and then, 23 years after Philip vanished, the investigation took a turn that, for a moment, felt seismic. Gardaí received specific information suggesting that Philip's remains might be buried on the grounds of Grange Golf Club in Rathfarnham, near Whitechurch Road and the M50. This was not a vague rumour or anonymous whisper. The tip indicated that a section of ground had collapsed in on itself, in a way investigators recognise as potentially consistent with a disturbed grave. Officers moved quickly. A wooded section of the course was sealed off. Vegetation was cleared. Forensic markers were placed. Access was restricted strictly to Garda personnel. The area under examination covered roughly half a hectare of overgrown land beside the road. For the first time in years, it felt as though the search might be narrowing. Specialist teams were brought in, every resource made available to try and solve the mystery of Philip's disappearance. There were geophysicists, forensic examiners and experts from the Garda Technical Bureau. More than 30 officers were assigned to the operation. It began with a detailed soil survey, using specialist equipment to establish whether the ground had been disturbed in recent decades. Only if anomalies were detected would full excavation begin. This was not a rushed search. It was a careful, methodical process. Over several days, the site became the focus of huge national attention. Philip's case had never faded. Media gathered outside the cordon. Front pages were splashed once again with Philip's face, and updates led the radio news bulletins across the big Dublin stations, 98 FM and FM 104, as well as being the top story on the 6-1 News on television. For the Kearns family, it was impossible to ignore. Once again, there was the possibility that this might finally bring answers. Philip's father told reporters that the family had learned to be cautious. "We have had other supposed developments before now," he said, "so it isn't a shock. We'll have to wait and see." Behind the restraint, hope was impossible to suppress. What the public didn't know is that this wasn't the first time investigators' attention was turned to the Grange Golf Club. In the late 1980s, a woman had told Gardaí that a friend had claimed to have murdered Philip and buried him at the golf club. That lead had been investigated at the time, but no evidence had been found. Now, with new information and new technology, they were returning to it. For 3 days, teams worked through the site. Every layer of soil was documented. Every anomaly was tested. No stone was left unturned, in the most literal sense. Every possibility was explored. Then the operation ended. No announcement or fanfare. Nothing to see here. They found no remains, no clothing, no evidence, and still, after all these years, no trace of Philip. Once again, a moment that had seemed full of promise collapsed into silence. The golfers returned to the course, the cordon came down, and the cameras moved on. And the Kearns family were left, yet again, with nothing but questions. Each time, hope rose. Each time, it collapsed. More years passed, and public attention faded. Leads dried up, and with no new ones emerging, the case slipped quietly into the background. But Philip's parents never stopped asking. They never stopped hoping someone somewhere would finally speak. And then, in May 2016, almost 30 years after Philip vanished, the case suddenly came back to life. A woman came forward with information she said she had been carrying for years. She told Gardaí the name of the person responsible for Philip's disappearance. She witnessed Philip being attacked by this person herself. For the first time in 30 years, Gardaí were focused on one man. In May 2016, almost 30 years since Philip Kearns vanished, a breakthrough appeared out of the blue. A woman by the name of Angela Copley contacted investigating Gardaí with significant information. An advocate for abuse victims, Miss Copley said she had been approached by a woman who told her who was behind the abduction and murder of Philip Kearns. The level of detail the woman went into led her to believe she was very credible. Once told, detectives were of the very same opinion. This was not a rumor. It was not speculation. It was a detailed first-hand account, and at its center was a name. A name that had never before been publicly linked to Philip's disappearance. A man who had once been well-known in Dublin. A man who had built a career in broadcasting. A man who, behind that public image, had a long history of abuse and violence. That man was Eamon Cook. For so long, the case had no named suspect. That changed on June 10, 2016, when Irish media reported that Gardaí believed a convicted paedophile DJ, Eamon Cook, may have killed Philip Kearns. The news, having leaked from the guard's meeting with Angela Copley and the witness, was startling, but also for many not surprising. It fit the terrible pattern many suspected, that a predator had taken Philip. But it gave that predator a name and a face at last. Eamon Cook was notorious in Dublin. He'd been the founder of Radio Dublin, a pirate radio station that was popular in the 70s and 80s, one that Philip no doubt listened to. On face value, he was known as a pioneer of pirate radio, a somewhat eccentric character, with nicotine-stained fingers and a constant cigarette in his mouth. Cook was a thin, lightly built man with a narrow frame and slightly stooped posture. He had a physically unimposing presence. His hair was sparse and receding, pale grey and brushed back from a high forehead, leaving much of his scalp exposed. What remained was wispy and uneven. His face was long and angular, with sunken cheeks and deep lines around the eyes and mouth. The kind of fella who always looked old. Cook had sharp features and a gaunt, tired look. On paper, he bore a resemblance to the description given by the motorist on Ballyroan Road that October afternoon in 1986. A man around 50, with grey, unkempt hair, seated behind the wheel of a red car as a schoolboy in a calash to any uniform approached the passenger side. It was not proof, but it was a detail investigators did not ignore. His slight frame and unassuming look hid a dangerous secret. Cook was a prolific and violent paedophile. He had multiple convictions for sexually abusing children, and by 2016 he was serving a 10-year sentence for abusing two girls in the 1970s. Cook's criminal history was long. Once in 1957, he even shot at Gardaí during an incident and served time. He was sentenced to 5 years penal servitude, after pleading guilty to shooting at four Gardaí as they inspected a parked car in Bray, County Wicklow. In the 1980s, he was convicted of an arson conspiracy as well. Cook was violent and predatory. In 2016, the woman at the centre of this new line of inquiry made a decision she had been unable to make for almost 30 years. She agreed to give Gardaí a full signed statement. For decades, she had carried what she said she had witnessed on the day Philip disappeared, afraid of the man she accused, and afraid of what might happen if she spoke. She too was one of Cook's victims, and believed he had power over her long after the abuse had ended. She had first approached Gardaí in 2011, after a public appeal on the Crime Call TV show on RTE, but at that time she could not bring herself to formally stand over her account. She never signed the statement. In 2016, that changed. After learning that Cook was seriously ill and nearing the end of his life, she decided it was finally safe to put her name to what she knew. For the first time, she committed her story to paper and placed it in the hands of investigators. The witness said Cook had promised Philip a tour of his radio studio in Inchicore, about 10 kilometres from where Philip was last seen. She claimed that while showing him around, something went horribly wrong. A row broke out and Cook attacked Philip. The woman, who was 9 years old at the time, told Gardaí that she'd been in another room when she heard raised voices and argument. She said she then went to see what was happening. She saw Cook strike Philip on the head with a blunt implement. According to her statement, Philip fell to the ground unconscious, with blood visible around his head. She said she panicked and ran towards the front door. As she tried to escape, Cook caught up with her. After that, she said, she blacked out, possibly fainting with the fright. She awoke with Cook in his car and no sign of Philip. She also claimed that Cook orchestrated having Philip's bag removed from wherever the actual crime took place, and later directed some children to dump the bag in the laneway where it was found. Her statement explained the bag mystery. It was deliberately planted to confuse the investigation, done at Cook's command by kids who perhaps didn't fully grasp what they were doing. This lined up with what Gardaí had long suspected, that the bag was planted, and possibly that local youngsters were used in that process. Gardaí moved quickly. They travelled to Arbor Hill Prison, where the 79-year-old Cook had been serving his sentence. But when they arrived, they were told he had been transferred to St. Francis Hospice in Raheny. Cook was dying. He had terminal lung cancer. A lifetime of chain smoking had caught up with him. He was now frail, weak, and heavily medicated. Two detectives arranged to interview him at his bedside. One of them was retired Detective Sergeant Tom Doyle, who had headed the investigation from Farnham Garda Station since 1998. After years of dead ends and unanswered questions, Doyle was finally sitting across from the man who might be able to give the Kearns family some measure of closure. Cook was not now merely a person of interest, he was their prime suspect. During the interview, Cook struggled to breathe. He drifted in and out of consciousness. Because of his condition, detectives were limited to simple yes and no questions. Time was against them. They asked him if he knew Philip Kearns. He indicated that he did. He also confirmed other limited details which Doyle believed supported parts of the witness's account. Later, Doyle recalled the encounter. When interviewing him on his deathbed, some of his comments sent chills down my spine, he said. At one stage, we thought he was going to confess. We interviewed him and planned to take it further. Then we learned he had passed away. We were so close, yet so far. Cook passed away on June 4, 2016, just days after that interview with Gardaí. With any possibility of further questioning gone, detectives turned back to the physical evidence. Philip's school bag was sent for modern forensic testing. They hoped advances in DNA analysis might finally link Cook to the case. But the bag had been handled by countless people over the years. The chain of custody was broken. For long periods, it had been kept in a desk drawer rather than in a sealed evidence bag. In 1986, the type of DNA testing needed simply did not exist. In August 2016, Gardaí completed their tests. The results showed no forensic link was found between Cook and the bag. His DNA did not match any of the samples recovered. This was a letdown. It meant scientifically that there was no proof to corroborate the witness's story. But it's also not surprising. Decades had passed. The bag was handled by a large number of people. Cook might have worn gloves or had others handle the bag. The absence of DNA doesn't clear him. In fact, Gardaí were clear to point out that Cook had not been ruled out despite the lack of a forensic match. The case was still considered active and ongoing. Tom Doyle later said it remained possible that Cook's DNA had once been present, but that decades of contamination had made reliable analysis impossible. The samples were compromised. They contained multiple profiles. Technology capable of separating them did not yet exist in Ireland. Within Garda circles, they had a shortlist of suspects. Cook seemed to be the strongest lead, but the public and media generated their own stories. There was the neighbour theory, a known sex offender living in the area in 1986. One persistent theory in some circles was about an alleged paedophile ring operating in South Dublin in the 70s and 80s, a ring that might have abducted children. Broadcaster Gareth O'Callaghan, a distant relative of the Kearns, became an outspoken voice on this in recent years. He used his platform to claim that blaming a single dead man in Eamon Cook was too easy and that a group of men were involved and protecting each other. O'Callaghan passed on names to the Gardaí, including the suggestion to dig in one particular garden where he believed Philip's remains might be. Gardaí did look at that information. They said it was being examined, though they didn't immediately launch an excavation without solid grounds. To date, that angle hasn't led to a breakthrough either. The Sunday Independent advanced the theory that Philip had been subjected to abuse by someone outside his immediate family, and that he was later killed after disclosing that abuse to another adult. In a piece published in 2002, it was claimed that the man Philip confided in was himself involved in abusing children and had passed information back to the original abuser. When reflecting on the effect that article had at the time, Philip's brother Owen said it shifted attention away from other potential avenues. It distracted people from coming forward or thinking back about connections, maybe something strange they noticed, he said. From what can be established, the claims outlined in that article originated from journalistic investigation rather than a formal Garda line of inquiry. Gardaí consistently stated that they remain open to examining any credible information in the case. The same report also proposed that Philip's remains had been concealed in a pond, later developed into a tennis court and adjoining nursing home complex. But that suggestion does not align with the timeline provided by Owen. He maintains that the pond had already been drained and the area redeveloped before Philip went missing. In the absence of answers, people sought their own explanations. Was it a lone predator? An opportunistic abuser? A larger conspiracy? A cover-up? On the more far-fetched end, some even speculated about clerical involvement or high-level cover-ups, given Ireland's history of institutional abuse and Philip's religious upbringing. It was certainly plausible, though no evidence has emerged to support these theories in Philip's case. For Philip's mother, Alice, the unanswered questions never went away. In a 2016 interview, she reflected on how her son might have been approached had Cook been the man responsible for his disappearance. He could have said, "I'm a DJ, I'll give you a lift, I'm going up there," she said. He might have thought, "Look who gave me a lift." For investigators, the case had reached another impasse. Their only remaining hope was that someone else, somewhere, might still come forward. In 2021, the Kearns family issued another public appeal. Philip was a happy, warm and caring young boy who was dearly loved, they said. We feel his loss every day. He is always in our hearts and thoughts. We appeal again to anyone who may have information to contact Gardaí. For nearly four decades, the disappearance of Philip Kearns has been marked not by silence, but by noise. A constant stream of tips, rumours, sightings, anonymous calls, supposed confessions, claims of secret burials, allegations of organised abuse, searches that yielded nothing, and leads that appeared promising before collapsing under scrutiny. From the very beginning, the investigation was flooded with information. Most of it was false. Some of it was sincere, from good-natured, well-meaning people, but mistaken. Some of it may yet prove significant. But separating truth from distraction became one of the greatest challenges Gardaí faced. In the days after Philip vanished in October 1986, extensive searches were carried out across Dublin, with hundreds of volunteers combing every lane, field and green space. When Philip's school bag appeared in a narrow laneway close to his home, it provided investigators with one crucial insight. Someone, somewhere, had control of his belongings after he disappeared. In the years that followed, theories multiplied, yet nothing was ever found. No body or physical evidence capable of proving what had happened. It meant an arrest and charge would be very difficult. The most credible witness in the case, the woman whose account ultimately brought Gardaí to Eamon Cook as he lay in hospice care, had taken the investigation further than it had gone in years. But Cook did not confess. He offered no explanation. He gave no indication of what became of Philip. And within days, he was dead. Once again, the investigation stalled. Looking back across nearly 40 years, that pattern repeats. At multiple points, strong leads surfaced, each appearing to offer clarity, but ultimately failing to deliver certainty. The result of this was confusion, the erosion of trust, and an investigation repeatedly complicated by misinformation, leaks, and untested claims. There is no evidence that the case was deliberately obstructed, but there is clear evidence that it was repeatedly diverted. For Philip's family, that confusion came at a terrible cost. They lived first with hope, then with uncertainty, and eventually with the quiet acceptance that their son was never going to come home. Alice Kearns never stopped thinking about Philip, and she never stopped looking for answers. She died in November 2025 without knowing what happened to him. Her husband, Philip Sr., died in 2014. Neither lived to see their son brought home. Today, Philip remains legally classified as a missing person rather than a murder victim, because without a body and without more concrete evidence of foul play, the law cannot say more. Yet many who worked on the case believe he was killed. Retired Detective Sergeant Tom Doyle has publicly stated that he believes the investigation should formally be upgraded to murder. Others share that view. But belief is not evidence, and evidence is what ultimately matters. That final decisive proof has never been found. What can be said with certainty is that Philip Kearns did not simply run away, and he did not disappear by accident. He was a quiet, conscientious 13-year-old boy, devoted to his family, settled in school and looking forward to his future. He left his house on a short walk back to school and never arrived. Something happened to him in that brief window of time, and someone knows what that was. Almost 40 years later, the case remains open. The files are still active. Appeals continue. Gardaí maintained that even the smallest piece of information could prove significant. If you have any information about Philip's disappearance, Gardaí at Rathfarnham Garda Station can be contacted on 01 866-6500. And if, for any reason, you feel unable or afraid to make that call directly, you can contact us confidentially at linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we will ensure that any credible information is passed on appropriately. Even after all this time, that call could matter. Because in cold cases, the truth does not always emerge through technology or forensic breakthroughs. Sometimes it comes when a person finally decides to speak, whether out of conscience, fear, or the simple recognition that time is running out. Until Philip is found, this story is unfinished. Until his family can bring him home, justice remains incomplete. And until the truth is known, Ireland is left with one of the most painful unanswered questions. What happened to Philip Kearns? Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review. I am very grateful that to date we have over 3,000 5-star reviews on Spotify. I would appreciate it if you could give our Instagram page a follow, at Lines of Inquiry Podcast, and sharing it to your story on social media. If you're on Spotify, please leave a comment below, or simply recommend the podcast to a friend. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Siobhan Walsh and Siobhan Maguire are our producers. This episode was written by Emma McMenemy and edited by Darren Cleary. Sound design and editing by Neil Kavanagh. Legal, marketing and social media support comes from the team at Go Loud. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.